Welcome to this podcast series on inclusion and education from the University of Leeds. Our research brings together experts in education, childhood and youth studies with an aim to promote equality across family, education, policy, legal and community settings. To read more about our work, please visit the School of Education website. You can find this link and others discussed during the podcast in the programme description.
Hello, my name's Luke McFarlane, and welcome to episode 3. So today we have two special guests. So would you like to introduce yourselves?
I'm Imogen, and I did a Master's in Childhood Studies at the University of Leeds, alongside Camilla, actually, who's also on the podcast today.
Hi, I'm Camilla. I work at the University of Leeds currently within the Leeds Social Sciences Institute. But prior to that, I worked as a research fellow with Dr. Jill Main on a couple of participatory research projects centred around children and family poverty.
So what is your current experience with inclusion and education to do with young people?
As I mentioned, in the couple of research projects that I worked on with Dr. Jill Main, participation was very much embedded in the way that we conducted that work. So the approach that we took to those projects was about placing children and young people and their priorities for research at the centre of the research design.
So I did the Master's in Childhood Studies and did a module on child poverty, and also did some research that specifically focused on children and young people's experiences of food poverty and food insecurity. And then since then, I joined Leeds City Council. A lot of the work we do is with children and young people, and we challenge poverty and inequality, whether that be linked to education specifically, like you mentioned, or whether that be linked to food or opportunities or lack of opportunities.
Thank you very much. You both in common have used a very unique methodology. Would you like to explain what you mean by participatory methods and how was this used?
Yeah, so participatory research is, I guess, an umbrella term really for research methods that are participatory, collaborative and inclusive. So they were used previously to carry out community-led research for learning and collective action. So they've got kind of their origins in developing countries where engaging the views and expertise of local people is seen as crucial to developing sustainable development strategies. But I'd say over the last 20 or so years, that kind of approach has been successfully adapted and used in the UK. So the foundations of participatory research are that they're interactive, more visual tools really that can be used to overcome barriers around literacy and numeracy. So it's an attitude of engagement really that places people with direct lived experiences of something as the experts in their own lives really. So in that way, it allows communities to identify issues that affect them, analyse them together, and then identify ways to address them, bringing in whichever stakeholders are the most relevant. So in that sense, it's more than gathering data, which I alluded to before. So practicing participatory research is a lot about developing relationships, sharing knowledge, building bridges between different stakeholders, and really just creating a forum where different issues can be identified. And I think it's really important to maintain throughout conducting a project in this way, a research project in this way, is that people, it's not about building it coming to an agreement or a consensus on something, but it's just about providing a safe space, an accessible space where people can speak about their different attitudes on a topic and do that collectively. So it's kind of in that way, I suppose, challenging traditional locations of power in research. So as a researcher, you go in much more as a facilitator of a conversation, and those that are considered traditionally as subjects of research, the ones that researchers usually conducted on, become co-researchers in shaping and conducting and sharing that research. So I think that this metaphor of handing over the pen is really a really powerful one and really helpful one in thinking about participatory research, because as a researcher, you don't go in with an agenda specifically of what you want to extract or get out, which is perhaps slightly unusual for research, but it's more that you hand over the power and the responsibility to the experts by experience to think about, okay, what is it that we want to talk about and in which direction do we want to take the conversation? So I say that those are perhaps the main elements, the key tenets really of participatory research from my understanding.
Just to jump in on that point just very quickly, a great example of participatory methods was when you were working with the Sharefields to make snakes and ladders. Could you explain the process that you went by to create that and how it involved the young people and helped them create?
Yeah, definitely. So as part of one of the research projects that I worked on with Jill was called A Different Take, and it was about gathering the viewpoints of families, so children, young people and adults with lived experiences of poverty in the north and south of the country, to develop panels to speak about their experiences and then think about what solutions there could be to mitigate those impacts of poverty or to go about solving the issues at the core. And so within the Leeds panel that we had, so it was a project that we did in collaboration with partners as well, I should say. So it was a project that we did with Leeds City Council in Leeds, and then our partner was Child Poverty Action Group in London, a campaigning sort of advocacy organisation. So two different partners as well, which was an interesting element to doing the research, not just doing research in a different way, but doing it with two different partners who potentially had different expectations also of what the outputs and outcomes would be. But to speak specifically to that example, within the Leeds panel, we used one of the research tools we used was snakes and ladders. And in that way, we had, because it was an intergenerational project, we split parents, young people and children off into subgroups, and they each developed their own boards, initially just on pieces of paper really, and they drew out a typical snakes and ladders board, and they used the squares within that board to place quotes about that reflected their direct experiences of living in poverty from various different areas. So some covered aspects of period poverty, food poverty, feelings of exclusion and missing out at school, and fears about lack of employment opportunities going forward. So a real breadth of direct quotes from the panels themselves were captured in that way. And then we used the snakes and ladders themselves and also wrote quotes on them as ways for the panels to start thinking about the ladders, which were the aspects of their lives that they found helpful in elevating them out of the depth of poverty or the gravity of a particular situation. So to give an example, some of the parents talked about single parenthood, that for them was one of the aspects of their lives that was exacerbated by poverty. And they talked about having really friendly neighbours that helped with childcare, something that really helped them out of a difficult situation and a difficult time. So in that way, the ladders were used as a literal tool. They were written on, created by lollipop sticks by the panels, and then later converted to a digital form of that board. But they were used to show what elevated families out of a situation. But alternatively, the snakes were used to represent things that made life a lot more difficult. So the children might talk about having a difficult relationship with teachers, for example, or teachers giving them a hard time about not having completed the homework when they didn't have the adequate digital resources to do so, as something that dragged them down and made life more difficult. And to use the metaphor of the snakes and ladders board, kind of brought them down and made them feel like they were kind of not able to progress in life, as they wouldn't have physically been able to progress on the snakes and ladders board. And that turned out to be a really interesting, it was really interesting how the panel adapted that tool that they'd used initially just as a tool to generate conversation, and the way that they internalised the snakes and ladders that then became metaphors that they used. And in fact, the report that we produced capturing all of the data that we gathered around the from the Leeds panel's perspective of life on poverty and the solutions was then called More Snakes Than Ladders. And that was one of the suggestions and a direct quote from one of our panel members where they were saying, actually, my life is full of a lot more snakes than it is ladders. So I think that turned out to be a really interesting creative tool that was initially used just to generate discussion, but became really embedded in the way that the panel talked about their experiences and the ladders they used in the report to talk about solutions or potential ways to mitigate impacts of poverty. And then we then took those to council meetings and had council members and policymakers, practitioners sat around a table with the panel members themselves playing the game. And I think it was really powerful having everybody on the outside looking in on a game that actually was a representation of all the problems that the panels felt were linked to their lives living on a low income. And it was almost like, this is the problem in the middle of the table. How are we all going to work together to try and come up with a solution or with solutions? So yeah, it was a really interesting experience using that, and it went off in a completely different direction to what we anticipated it would, but in the best way.
Thank you very much. Imogen, what would be your experiences of using participatory methods?
So when I was on the Childhood Studies Masters, I did my dissertation, my research project on children's experiences of food poverty and insecurity. And I identified a gap. There was very, very little research involving children and young people themselves around food poverty. And it is a highly sensitive topic, of course, but it's so important. There was some research that had been published, but it mainly spoke to parents about their experiences. And an example which really kind of highlights the importance of having children and young people's voices heard is that parents in this situation often go without food so that their children can eat. But children are often aware this is happening, and there's evidence of children reducing how much they eat or not asking for snacks or not asking if their friends can come over for tea because they're aware of the poverty and the food poverty and insecurity. So it's absolutely fundamental that children's voices are included. So I decided to research children's perceptions and experiences of food within the wider context of food poverty, but the questions were kept quite broad. Because I acknowledge the sensitivity around the questions. So Camilla mentioned that in participatory research, the researcher doesn't go in with a set agenda. And that slightly differed from the research that I did because I did have an agenda of food and it was set within the food poverty context. However, Camilla will be able to explain more, but participatory research is a continuum, and so my research wasn't all-encompassing participatory research, but there were elements of the actual methodology that I used that does link. So I used what we would call creative methods. So an example of this is I gave each child, so 16 children, 8 to 10 years old, that took part, and they all attended a school in a deprived area of Leeds, which had significantly higher than average free school meal rates, and that was used as one indicator of poverty. So I gave each child a paper plate and asked the children to draw their favourite food on the plate, and then on the back of the plate, write an explanation about what they'd drawn. And it was a really fun activity. The children really enjoyed it. And it was a way of introducing the topic of food, but in quite a fun and exciting way, and also building a relationship between the children and myself as the researcher. It was all done in a school setting, but the children knew that I didn't work for the school and that I'd come in as a guest. To try and separate the work a little bit from school. And I would say that the use of that creative method, the paper plates and the drawing activity, really facilitated subsequent communication that we had, because I went on to do focus groups with the children. And I also used another creative tool within the focus group. So I gave each child a red and a green card. And green was to symbolise that the participants were happy and that they were comfortable with the research and the questions. And then red was to symbolise that there was a problem, whether that be that they needed to ask a question. You know, one thing that we'd both like to emphasise is that including children and young people's voices is key. And I think we would both acknowledge that it is complex, especially when you have rigorous ethics processes within universities, and absolutely rightly so. But I hope that the research that both Camilla and colleagues and I have conducted shows that it can be done, and there are ways and means of using creative methods and participatory research that allows that. And I would say that the creative methods that I use definitely facilitated some really stark findings that I can share with you. So one of the key findings was that food has really significant social importance to children and young people. Food brings people together. The children were really keen to share that, and there was evidence of sharing food amongst children and neighbourhoods. And it also has significant cultural meaning. The children told me about birthdays and different celebrations, and food is a key part of that. So you can begin to see how not only does food have, or a lack of food, have a physical impact on children and young people, but it also has a significant negative impact on their social lives and their social needs. So there was indications, as I previously mentioned, of food security amongst the children and young people that participated in the research. There was mentions of backup food at home and what children might eat when the rest of the foods ran out. And there was mention of children having free school meals as their main meal, and then at home just being able to have a snack.
But I think it was really interesting for me on this intergenerational project with a different take to see that it's that those power dynamics between and relationships between participants, they also varied between the groups and over time within the groups. So in the earlier meetings, I frequently saw reproductions of like normative power relationships based on age. And there was a particular instance where there was actually a parent and child relationship within one of the panels, within the Leeds panel. And we were talking about how poverty affects potentially how you feel physically and what you might be able to do. And one of the children wrote that for them, poverty looks like rags. And a young person then about so 5 or so years older than them, past 16, said, ask why have you put rags? And the child says, because you have to wear old clothes in it. And the young person said, that's not rags. And the child said, same thing. And then his mum overheard him and said, what did you say? And the other parent kind of said, living in poverty, yeah, so what? And the child said, yeah, people who are poor have to wear dirty old clothes. And the young person says, not necessarily. And a bit of a situation ensues in which basically that the young child is criticised for speaking about poverty in such a way. And it's difficult to say the reasons for that, but I think it's really interesting and highlights the importance of inviting children and young people to speak about their experiences, because there are already these normative power relationships at play in various aspects of life. And I felt like as a researcher in that situation, it was important to have provided the space for that young person to talk about for them what poverty felt like. And it was quite interesting towards the end of that interaction. The kind of the tone of the conversation changed. And I think the young person, I'm suspecting, but I can't say this for definite, of course, but I think they recognised that they were reinforcing a stigma or a shame around poverty that the rest of the group members didn't agree with. And one of the young people said, for some people, it might be a choice to wear old clothes. And then another young person said, yeah, or the person wearing it might be a builder or something. And then another young person said, builders get good money. And then the child said, yeah, they wear dirty old clothes when they're working. So then the young person said, what's that got to do with living in poverty? And the child said, nothing. And it was really interesting how they'd started to say that for them, poverty looked like rags. That's what they wrote. But actually in that exchange, it's really interesting to and very stark to see how the relationships with those older than them, kind of they were trying to change or influence the way in which the child was trying to talk about what it meant for them. And so I think it just reinforces the point that it's important for us as researchers to, through tools and like this, to provide a space where everybody has an equitable say in their experiences of poverty and other issues that affect them as well.
Okay. So I would say that the experience and the context of working in a food bank and then doing the research for my childhood studies dissertation helped me in my roles in the council, both in the child poverty placement and also in my role as a senior localities officer. One project that I've worked on is Healthy Holidays, which is about offering that targeted food and activity children for children and young people experiencing poverty. And my understanding of children and young people's experiences has definitely given me a foundation for my work in the council, in practice, in communities. And one thing that we follow in the communities team is asset-based community development, or ABCD approach. And that really links to the participatory methods and the creative methods, but in a slightly different way, in a more on the ground way, I would say. So ABCD is about work being led by communities. So it's about listening to the community, working with communities, and building on assets in the community. And assets might be having a local community centre. An asset might be that someone in the community has a particular skill. So people are your assets, community centres, green space, many different things. And it's about identifying those assets and building on them. So it's an approach that we say is what is strong and not what's wrong in communities. And I think that that approach very much links to the participatory research, because the community are really guiding the work. So as someone in the community's team, there might be 5+ people in the same position, but we work with different communities and our roles look so different to each other because we are truly guided by the local community that we work with. And we acknowledge that community work isn't a blanket approach, and it's not about looking at a citywide approach. It's about the localized community and their specific needs and assets. And I think that's very similar to participatory research and the A Different Take project that Camilla was spoken about, because the research was guided by what the children and young people and their parents and carers said, and what was important to them. And that's a similar approach that we take in community work. And so an example of ABCD in practice would be me working with a particular community group who are very grassroots led. They are people that live in the community, they're volunteers, but they're very passionate about their community and they wanted to see some change in their community. So they came together, identified their assets and what skills they had, and there was a local community centre and they were able to really utilise that and offer some provision for many different groups of people in the community, including children and young people, and they've been hugely successful. And my role is to be supportive of that and facilitate and be that connect to the council, but the work that we do is always based on their skills and their knowledge and their ideas and their experiences of living in that community. Specifically now we're working on a localised doorstop gym offer. So there's barriers to accessing gyms for this particular community for many reasons. And the community group I worked with identified that there was a need for this, and that people wanted to access the gym. And so we thought, okay, well, we'll do one in the local community centre. And we've now built a gym. We put in funding applications, and we got the finance to do it. And it was based on the skills and the knowledge of the community. And we really wanted it to be localised. So two key volunteers in the area who are really interested in sport and fitness and physical activity have been funded to do a qualification which will enable them to lead the gym. So it will be a community gym led by the community for the community. So I support them in doing this, and I facilitate the work, but this is about what that community needed and what that community wanted to drive. So hopefully that gives a bit of context about how similar methods can be used in practice as well. And I think it's not always as formal as the academic research process, but there's kind of strengths and weaknesses of both. So
Imogen, speaking from your experience, how has COVID-19 affected food poverty?
Yeah, so as I mentioned at the start, I work for Leeds City Council in the communities team, and we work with the priority neighbourhoods and target wards. So we have seen implications of COVID-19 and poverty levels worsening. We know nationally that COVID-19 has disproportionately affected the most deprived communities. And additionally, many people's employment has been affected. And what we know about in-work poverty is that particular employment such as zero-hour contracts and temporary contracts can trap people in a cycle of poverty or kind of living on the borderline of poverty. And many of the contracts or people's employments that's been affected are of that nature. So definitely, I would say that there are elements of poverty worsening because of COVID-19. In relation to food poverty and children and young people's experiences of food poverty specifically, there's been a variety of government funded initiatives which have helped children and young people. And that's something that's been new this year, such as the COVID winter grant scheme. So in Leeds, we use that to provide food for children and young people experiencing poverty. And we were, as a council, able to support significantly more children with this funding. Our concern is that funding is time limited. So the COVID winter grant scheme, for example, is due to end in April. So we have May half term around the corner and then summer. And whilst children and young people are at school, if they are eligible for free school meals, they will of course receive that provision. But over the school holidays, that provision stops. That's been slightly different throughout the last year. There has been more provision available, but in normal terms, prior to the pandemic, that the free school meals stopped over the school holidays, which caused food poverty to worsen, especially over the longer duration of the summer holidays. And that's kind of where Healthy Holidays comes in. So Healthy Holidays is a project that provides targeted provision to children and young people experiencing poverty. Eligibility for free school meals is used as one indicator of that, but there are children and young people living in poverty that are not eligible for free school meals due to various reasons. So it's important to note that it is just one indicator. So Healthy Holidays, we've had funding for the last couple of years from the Department for Education, and we had that again in 2020. And we have now found out we'll have funding for 2021, but we don't know about 2022. It's difficult to plan with the funding. Local communities were involved. So the Healthy Holidays programme has three elements. It has the element of school providers, third sector organisations and community groups, and Leeds City Council community hubs. And trusted members of communities were awarded funding following an application process to deliver provision. And they do that in the way that they see best for that community. So the provision is guided by that community. The fundamental core is that it's about food and activity provision. But beyond that, the group or the local school or the community hub can build a project around the specific community that they're serving.
Thank you, Camilla and Imogen.
Thank you for listening. For more information about our work, please visit the School of Education website. If you have any questions about our research, or if you would like to study with us at the University of Leeds, you can contact the Research Centre Director, Professor Michalis Kontopodis, for further details. You will find all relevant links and contact details in the programme description.